So that was the lemma, that the substitution lemma, which was necessary, as we found out, for solving the exercise. And I sketched the proof of that lemma on Thursday.
Substitution should be normal brackets, right?
Yes. These ones?
Yeah. I was just typing things literally and it didn't match.
Okay. There's a dash here. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, so that's something that we discussed on Thursday. And I've sketched a proof, and there were some subtleties in the proof, and they didn't manage to fix it. So I looked at it offline and find out what the problem was. So the proof was by induction. And the most interesting case was the one where Q was equal to do Y gets ST. So that was the most interesting case, and so we've calculated these two things. So the left-hand side and the right-hand side. So this side Q PX. That was calculated correctly. So it was calculated like this. We've got so F is this. And then there was H. So it must be just B. And there was W. So W was this thing. So is it actually consistent in terms of typing? So I think this is all right. And then there were some problems with the right-hand side. So the right-hand side was like this. So that's the right hand side, it's equal to the following thing. So these guys are the same, as we found out, but this is not equal to that, and I didn't bring you to the end yet. So there's one thing here, which is a bit not very formal. I've introduced the swap functions, which rearranges the types in the context. So I just explain it roughly how it works, but in principle, it's something that needs a proof. But then again, there is yet another thing which requires a proof, and namely, so the mistake was that I've just replaced this by H, I guess. This is probably not T, this must be. Something is wrong here. So F is used twice, and then there is H. And this must be. This must be P, right? Right, so the problem was that I've replaced this by F, but now when you write down all the context, you see that it's not F, because F depends only on gamma, and this turn depends on gamma and yet another variable. So this semantics is not F, it's F composed with the projection to gamma, and that does the job. So here, if I want to call F, I need basically call the projection. F projection 1. And so if I simplify this expression, because swap has a concrete definition, then I just get the same thing. So let's call it star. So this would be equal to star. So we did this calculation, but it didn't match precisely because this projection wasn't there. And if you recover the projection, then it works. Yeah, so essentially there are two claims here which I used, auxiliary claims about rearranging the context and weakening the context. So when I remove some variables from the context on which I don't remember, this is called weakening. And apparently there is yet another lemma in the background here which I'm using and which I would like to state formally because because there are too much hand waving otherwise. So let's call it lemma weakening permutation. So let's assume that we have got these two terms in context. So the terms is the same all the time, but the context varies. And this is a larger context in the sense that this contains all the variables from gamma. And therefore, the size of delta is bigger than the size of the gamma. But even if they are equal, they can be different because we can have a permutation there. So we can have x and y in gamma and y and x in delta. So the question is how the semantics of these two things are related. This is something very basic, which I actually must have had formulated quite early. And at least, but now we see where it's actually needed. Then So this is a small x here. So that's not the end yet, but I just stopped for a while to comment it. So basically, this sigma is some function which combines permuting the arguments, permutation of arguments, and dropping the arguments. Because this delta might permute some of the okay, so this gamma with respect to delta, it may permute some arguments, and it can drop some arguments. So that's something that I want to capture here. And I do it by induction over gamma. So if gamma is just an empty context, then the sigma must be the unique terminal map, right? Because what else this could be? So if this is empty, then the semantics is the unit type. So there is just one map to the unit type. And if gamma is a singleton, basically I call an auxiliary function which basically construct an appropriate projection. So it searches for this x in delta and, returns an appropriate projection because every list is a product, a combination of binary brackets. And if you want to locate certain element there, then you need to do several times projection to the left and then possibly one projection to the right. So that's something that I'm going to specify further. And then in the case if gamma is of this sort, so it has one variable in the end, then I do my induction. So basically, I return this thing. No, is that correct?
You should probably swap the two.
Yes. Yes, this is how it looks. Thank you. Sigma x delta. Right, so this is my induction because it's about this part of the list, so the left one. And this is again about finding x in delta. And so how these things are constructed, x delta equal to id, if delta equal to delta prime y b and x is not equal to y. So in the end, that's just going to be a sequence of, well, it can be a sequence of left projections, or a sequence of left projections followed by right projection. And so basically, in this lemma, which have the corrected lemma which I present in the beginning, so we essentially use this this Wickenian permutation in two cases. Into places. So, example. So what was that example? We had something like xA, yB, so we want to express it via gamma yB and xA. So here we need to call this sigma with some density indexes. So this is gamma, I just omit the types, x and gamma xy. So, and this is something that we've called swap. And it's clear why, because it precisely swaps this to x and y. And now, using this definition, we can do to calculate it formally. Swap. Okay, which clause applies? So the third one. The third one applies. And therefore, we have sigma gamma prime, which is gamma y, and delta is the same. And here, basically, we need to calculate this function, so I just do it on the spot. So we need to locate this x in this tuple, so we need to project once to the left and once to the right. So in the end, this is just PR2, PR1. So that's something that you can get if you do this unfolded by using these definitions. And okay, so then by induction, so here there is one more variable, which means we call the induction again, sigma gamma x y, And here, this is just PR2. Okay, and basically, if I want to calculate this expression to the end, I need to prove by induction that this is equal to PR1 So I cannot unfold this because I don't know the length of gamma. So the only way to do this step would be just to prove it by induction. Because PR1. Because there are like brackets here, and so you project to the left and then again to the left, and then you get your gamma. So and this is, can be represented as PR1 ID, PR2 PR1. So does it match with the definition of swap which we have given? Hopefully, yes. Yes. So this is how it looks if one does it really formally, which is sort of unfortunate, yeah, so there doesn't seem to be a different way to do it. So in the beginning of the course, I was asked why we need to do the context instead of just doing sets, because the context just capture the variables on which your turn depends. I think now it's more clear why we need context, because we do the semantics formally, and then context, the semantics of context are products. And it's not clear what it would be with the sets, because we cannot form denotations of sets as some composition of the denotation of the elements. So the contexts are needed, and all this bureaucracy which belongs to it, it's sort of unavoidable. So we have these two things the same, both of them are derivable, and but then you need to show what the connection between them is, because they are just formally different, but of course, if we look at them, it's clear that they must be related, and the relation is like this. So this this lemma, it basically closes the that asymmetry which is created by the context. It repairs this asymmetry in a certain sense. What else? Okay, is that clear? Right, so we continue this sort of calculations, the exercise, I guess, because we want to proceed with the proofs with the expressivity lemma. So, and that's basically something which is sort of necessary for that. And I wanted to say a little bit more about the continuation monad. So I gave a quick intro and gave some examples. So just comment it a bit more. So, call CC has this type, A to TB, TA, TA, where TA is equal to A to R to R. Right, so if you unfold it completely, that's going to be something horrible. So one advantage of this definition like this is that we encapsulate the complexity of the continuation monad in this type, and now this type, the resulting type, is more compact. If we don't think don't bother what this T precisely is, so this is not such a bad type. And in Haskell, using the Haskell approach, this suggests the idea that instead of saying that T is equal to that, you just specify the class of monads which support this operator. So, and this is how it's done in Haskell. I don't quite remember what the class is, but It's a very Haskell way to do it like this. So instead of saying that this is just given, you say, okay, there is a class of monads which support call CC. So, and it's call CC is a method of this class, and then the continuation monad is an instance of such a class. But that's maybe too abstract. So before doing it like this, it's better to understand understand how it works for the continuation monad. So let me give the definition. For this function, assuming that T is really like this, so we need to apply it to something of this type, TB to TA, and then there is some K from A to R. Okay, so what it's equal to, it's equals to F lambda x lambda k prime, and then k of x k so basically there is like some continuation which is passed to call CC, and then there is a function which does something inside of the scope created by call CC. And the semantics of call CC is basically calling this function f with the continuation which is passed to call CC. But then if this function inside calls a continuation, we pass not the continuation which is the current one, but the one which was passed to call CC from the very outside. So we could replace it by a dash, which is what is done in Haskell implementation, because this k prime is never used. So, and I think it can be, this definition can be a little bit simplified if you consider an auxiliary function. Call CC prime right, because I'm not using this K prime anyway, so this type is not actually used as it stands. What I'm using from this type is just the return value. So this encodes B to R, but B to R is dropped. So I could consider something simpler like this. And this is something, in my opinion, simpler to understand because this does what? This turns a computation parameterized by a continuation into another computation. So here, this is like the body of this function, which is under call CC. And this is a parameter which can be called from inside. And call CC sort of abstract away this continuation here. So it returns just the computation. And how it does it, very easy in comparison to call CC. So we just can say that, can define it like this. Right, so this function would expect a continuation. So I pass this continuation as a parameter of this function, and then I pass the same continuation to the result. So sorry, I forgot the prime, which is important. And then I can express call CC via this call CC prime. Like this. So basically, I need to construct this simpler function from this more complex function, right? And I know how to do it because I know how this function is used in call CC. So by dropping the continuation, which is used here. So basically, I form a function like this, lambda k prime f of lambda x. Well, actually, I can remove this. Let's just check for sanity if this is correct. Call cc of f of k. No, just let's do it differently. Call cc prime of this lambda k prime f lambda x lambda dash x. And then let's use the definition of call cc prime, which produces what? It produces f lambda x lambda dash kx applied to k, which is precisely the expression for call cc. So, and now this type is not that scary as the original one, and we can try to unfold it. So essentially what we get here is this. And this type is isomorphic to, so if you look at this side, so I can do an uncurry here to uncurry this expression. So I can obtain r times a to r times r to a times r to a to r. And this is the essence of this operation then. So this is the basically these two continuations are two arguments which are available for a program inside of the call cc, because this is the current continuation. It's not now, after the transformations, maybe not such a fortunate term, because I don't know how to call this one. Maybe local continuation, local. So it's current with respect to call cc, but for the program which is inside call cc, it's not the current one. It's the one which was suspended at the place where the call CC was called, and it's available for the program. So the fact that I've got this type means that basically the program under call CC, it's parameterized by the current continuation, which was the one passed to the call CC, and the local one, which is the one inside the program, which it keeps transforming. So, and every program under call CC has an option either to call the current continuation, in the sense the current for call CC, the outermost one, or the local one. And that's the point. So, I can now even prove some properties of this operator. So, basically, if I take call CC prime of so basically, I have explicitly this two current continuation, local continuation, and then I can call some program like this, just normal program, either with that one or with this one, and the result is just the program applied to the one passed from the outside. So what this property says is that if you just call any of this continuation for the whole program, then the result is that program itself. So basically, this is like a corner cases where you do not make use of the facilities of call CC for like an emergency action or something. So you just call the program for one of these continuations. And of course, this doesn't cover the interesting cases. Where you have like a non-trivial use of these continuations, but I think it's still interesting, just sort of sanity condition saying that if you don't use the current continuation, then your program basically works as expected. So it's a non-destructive operation, for example. So I don't know if it's possible to formulate a theorem capturing interesting properties, because there are many, and I don't think there is one theorem capturing them. So how to prove it? I think the proof is easy. Okay, so what happens here? According to the definition, I have to duplicate this k and feed it to the argument. So I beta reduce it and I just get p of k. And so the second case is analogous. So then I can prove, have a corollary. So that's basically the statement for the standard call CC, saying that if you do not use the current continuation in your program, so you call the call CC and you bind some variable, but you don't use this variable in the program, then can call CC doesn't play a role, so you can just vanish, remove the simplify the program, just removing the call CC. So these are like the easily presentable cases for which the calculations are easy, and so the theorems are sensible. Otherwise, the further properties you basically experience when you start programming with that, and there is the exercise to this effect. So hopefully it will be helpful to understand further subtleties of it. Okay. So questions to that? No? Okay, so then there is the last topic which I wanted to cover, which is already found on the exercise sheet. I've called it algebraic monads. So there is yet another aspect of monads which is more familiar to mathematicians, that the monads can be seen as a metaphor for algebraic theories. So the theories like monoids and groups, etc. So there is a way to see them as monads, and that's relevant for theoretical computer science too, as we'll hopefully see. So I need to introduce an equational calculus to make sense of this notion. And this calculus is similar to the equational calculus for the computational meta language. So that's also an equational calculus. And this is another equational calculus, but it's much simpler than that, because the calculus for the meta language has binders, which so this do x gets, it's a binder. So that creates lots of troubles. And there is like a well-established and traditional notion of an algebraic theory, which was created before this more involved calculi with binders, and much simpler. So, and right. So I just repeat some definitions from the exercise sheet. So I'm using theta here because I don't want to confuse it with sigma, which we used in the meta language. So these are different sets. And right, so we postulate some signature of operations. And then we construct terms. We can basically construct terms just in the same way as we constructed them for the meta language. So, right, so if x is a variable, then it's a term. If we've constructed some terms, then we can apply a function symbol on top of it to get another term. So no context here. We just talk about free and bound variables. Well, there are not going to be any bound variables because we don't have binders. So we just, actually, yes, we can talk about bound variables. So the bound variables are just the ones which do not occur in the term. And Right. So these are the rules. Very familiar. Reflexivity, symmetry, transitivity, and congruence. And there's yet another rule, which is called instantiation. So if we have S equal to T, and then we can substitute a variable T R X. So we call it an algebraic theory, such a set of equations which are closed under these rules, or deductively closed. So deductively closed under the rules of the equation under the rules of equational logics. So these are precisely these rules. And there are lots of examples from mathematics where one deals with theories like this, like group theory or monoids. So, and we typically want to have an axiomatization. So it's like some set of equations which generate the rest of equations. So, and then we can speak of deductive closure of a set of equations, because this theory at normally contains an infinite number of equations, and we want a smallest basis, so which are called axioms, and they're not necessarily a unique set of axioms. We generate the rest, so we form a closure of the set of axioms by these rules, and then the result is an equation theory which is generated by these axioms. Right. So what's important about it? So one can prove this so-called Leibniz equality property. So the property, this Leibniz equality property, is that if two things are equal, then they are equal in any context. So I take a term R, and if two things are equal, then I replace one by the other, and again obtain an equality. So this is something to be proven as an exercise, and the corollary out from it is that basically if S equal to T is in theory and S1 equal to T1 well, in E and Sn equal to Tn in E, then we can replace so we can replace our equal things arbitrarily in every context. Proof. So we can decompose the sequence of substitution into two substitution and call the induction hypothesis here. So we would have T1 x1 and Tn minus 1 n minus 1 So this is an induction hypothesis by induction hypothesis plus instantiation because by induction hypothesis we can replace this by this, but also there is a substitution here, so to prove the whole thing equal we also need to call the instantiation axiom or the instantiation rule. Okay, and now so now what? Now we just use the fact that we have this Leibniz property. So we can replace this by Tn. something wrong? Okay, so this is all just like some elementary effects and something that that is possibly new to you is that we can now come up with monads generated by algebraic theories. So so I'm going to define a Kleister triple. Okay, it's not T theta, it's T E. Right. So TEX is the set of equivalence classes of terms over X theta under the equivalence relation. Well, that's probable equality under eta under E, and then eta X of X is equal to, is this notation familiar? Using here? In math. So this is the equivalence class containing X. And then the hardest case is that, so sigma star, well, let's say sigma X to T E Y star. So how do we define it? We have to define its action on T E X. So what are T E X? They are sets of equivalence classes like this. So, and basically, we say that the result is such a thing, T S1, X1, N, XN. Where S1 and the equivalence classes with S1 is the one which corresponds to the action sigma on X1. No, that's E. And so we need to make sure that the free variables of T are in the set. So we enumerate all possible variables, maybe more, but that doesn't matter. So right, so there's a small subtlety here, which is not obvious, because this sets X and Y, they can be infinite. We're doing it all over sets. But the point is, even the set of variables is infinite, we construct finite terms. And finite terms can depend only on finitely many variables. So even though these carriers X and Y potentially involve infinitely many variables, I still can correctly define this sort of construction, because I only interested in the variables which my turn depends on, and these are finitely many ones. Okay, one has to prove that this definition is correct, obviously, because this is fine and this is fine, but this is not necessarily fine, because here I basically define it with respect to a certain representative of the class, and it's not clear if I take another one, if it's going to be, if it's going to produce the same result. So if I take S instead of T, and also here, so if I take other representatives here, would this equation still hold? So I probably don't have time for that. Maybe we'll do it at the exercise. That basically follows from that corollary, from the corollary that I've proved. And yeah, basically we have to check if there's another candidate here and another candidate there. And then this is all coherent. And that's because everything is transparent with respect to equivalence. So what I wanted to ask is the how we want to organize the exam. So basically, we are almost in the end. I think we have got like one more lecture. So it's 14th, so that's still the semester. And 15th. 15th is also, right? But that's the last one. Yeah. So it's about time to decide when you want to have the exam. So what I want to do is I'm going to prepare some list of example questions, like what sort of things are going to be asked for your convenience. Just the example list. It doesn't mean that I ask only the, but so that you get the idea what sort of question can be there. But obviously, yeah, so if you listen to the course, there are going to be no surprises there. Right, so the exam is oral, 25 minutes, I guess. And my proposal would be to do it before the end of the July. How about that? In the last 2 weeks of July. What about that? Would it work? Later, that's the later one is in this September, because basically I'm not going to do it alone. I'm going to do it with the professor, and that his conditions. So there are school holidays, and I mean, basically he proposes to do either now until the end of July or then September. I mean, we can do some people now, some people later, but I'm not sure if anyone would like to transfer that far. I mean, I really recommend you to do it as soon as possible, because otherwise, so I can just leave you with that, and we can discuss it tomorrow. But yeah, as I said, our preference are like this. Okay. Thank you.